With the Tom Hartmann University Book Club today, we're reading from Healing ADD. Richard Bandler, the founder of Neurolinguistic Programming, NLP, wrote the foreword for this book. And it's basically a book on NLP as applied to people with ADHD. But it's actually a pretty good book on NLP, which is actually how I originally wrote it. So we're on chapter 8 on page 80, Reconstructing the Past. Different types of memories, regardless of how anchored in reality or fantasy they may be, are stored in our brains in different ways. These forms of storage involve the five sensory modalities, sight, smell, hearing, taste, and feeling, and the subtle gradations of each sense, such as color, brightness, or contrast for the visual modality, for example. These gradations are referred to as submodalities. This is true for both adults and children. One of the ways our brain organizes information is according to the way it's stored. Our senses pick up something in the outside world. Say we see an insect fly by. That's an objective thing that we've seen. However, before that image makes its way to our conscious brain, it's processed by other parts of the mind and tweaked and tuned. If it's a bug that frightens us, perhaps a wasp, then the mind sees it as a bigger object and in sharper contrast than it really is. Other objects in the picture, the background, buildings, grass, whatever, become more distant, dull, perhaps even less colorful. The mind may increase the volume of the sound associated with the wasp and also attach a feeling to the image, probably a variation on what we might interpret as fear or panic, a feeling felt perhaps in the pit of the stomach or the trembling of the hands. So here's a quick list of some of the submodalities that we commonly use to experience reality and store memory. In the visual field, color or black and white, so this is how do you remember things visually? Color or black and white, contrast, size, bordered or not, moving or still, brightness, graininess, distance from us, associated or disassociated. In other words, do we see the scene as we saw it, or do we see ourselves in it? Focus, detail, texture, perspective, dimensionality, is it flat or 3D? Proportion, that's the visual field. In auditory, loudness, tonality, distance, pitch, melody, inflection, location, tempo, duration. Gustatory, salty, sweet, spicy, musty, bitter, familiar, delicate. Olfactory, strong, faint, intermittent, familiar, unique, musty, moist, damp, mildewy. Kinesthetic, the feeling. Hard, soft, cool, warm, sharp, electric, intensity, duration, speed, location. Now here's the amazing part. If you know what modalities and submodalities your mind uses to store a particular type of memory, happy, sad, hopeful, afraid, neutral, whatever kind of memory it is, then you can adjust the memories you have of the past to change their emotional feel. For example, think of something, a memory of something that you did in the recent past, such as brushing your teeth last night. Mentally list the qualities of the submodalities. Your list might look something like mine. I see a still picture in black and white without a lot of contrast or detail. Associated, I see the mirror in the sink, but not myself. No border, 3D, about 2 feet square, about 20 feet away from me. I can hear the sound of the water running and taste the mint of the toothpaste. If I concentrate on it, I can remember or imagine remembering the feeling of the toothpaste on my toothbrush on my gum and the smell of the toothpaste. The feelings I associate with the memory are pretty neutral. Boredom might be the best way to describe it. It's something I do every night. Now imagine a control panel just below the image or wherever you'd like it to be with levers and dials that you can use to change the various submodalities. Reach out and change a few of the submodalities and see how things change. When I move the picture from black and white to color, I suddenly feel curious and interested in the process of brushing my teeth. It seems fascinating. If I turn up the volume, I become uneasy. As I increase the mint taste, I feel more awake. Nobody knows why this works the way it does. One theory is that the brain stores information holographically rather than digitally, so that the brain sees its own storage capacity as a three-dimensional space. Because we experience the world through our senses, it makes sense that we could organize the mechanism for storing the information about our experience of the world along sensory lines as well. When something is put into a particular space, it acquires the sensory nature of that space, since sensory signals are how we experience the world. So when a memory is put into the boring category in our brain, it becomes, in my case, everybody's different, but it becomes, for me, black and white still pictures and all the other submodalities I described before. When the submodalities are adjusted and the pictures are turned into a color movie, it doesn't just change the memory. It actually causes us to interconnect with or slide to a different storage place, a physical different storage space in my holographic brain. There's also a concept known as a critical submodality. That's the submodality which has the ability to shift others, probably the primary hook into the place in the brain hologram where the memory is stored. As you're going through the various submodalities, changing each one a bit in one way or another, turning up or down the brightness, the volume, you'll notice that there's generally one particular one. It could be anything from volume to contrast to smell to brightness, anything. It causes the entire picture to change and creates a sudden shift in the feelings associated with that memory. That submodality shift is the critical submodality. And once you know what your critical submodalities are, you can do this process much quicker. One of the most common and most powerful critical submodalities is location. When you move a picture from where it is, for example, in front and to the right, about 4 feet away, to some other place, for example, in front and slightly over your eyes, only a foot away, it often changes dramatically its impact. So it goes from there to talk about how to take memories that bother you or that haunt you even, and transform them into things that are simply just who cares memories. The book is Healing ADD, Simple Exercises That Will Change Your Daily Life.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Well, Donald Trump is out there doing it again, whether he's shooting himself in the foot or whether he is very wisely and cagily laying the foundation for the firing of Robert Mueller. I don't know. Could be both. Could be neither. Could be, you know, one or the other. The consensus of the chattering ninob community seems to be that he's shooting himself in the foot. But who knows? He tweeted this morning, they made up a phony collusion with the Russian story, found zero proof, so now they go for obstruction of justice on the phony story. Nice. You are witnessing the single greatest witch hunt in American political history, led by some very bad and conflicted people. Hashtag MAGA. Make America great again. Trump wrote. Right. So we'll see where this goes. I mean, the old cliche is that the cover-up is worse than the crime. And in fact, Bill Clinton got prosecuted or got impeached for the cover-up. Richard Nixon got impeached or resigned from office to avoid being impeached for the cover-up. I don't think we can take that before that to Andrew Johnson, but. Anyhow, where does this go? I don't know. You know, about 60% of the American people think that Trump is covering something up and that it probably has to do with the collusion between his campaign and the Russians, or whether it's just, you know, good old-fashioned corruption, or, you know, why won't he release his tax returns? Well, maybe it's because he's actually in debt and he lied to us all during the campaign and he's not even a – who knows? Who knows? But he doesn't want us to know. He does not want us to know. You would think if Donald Trump had absolutely nothing to hide that he would be saying, great, do your job. Come on in. I'll talk to you. And you know, I get it that that could be interpreted as a variation on the, you shouldn't fight for, you know, privacy rights because, hey, people who are innocent have nothing to hide. That's not the argument I'm making here. I mean, there are very clear and serious allegations out there that have been made by people from the former FBI director and Hillary Clinton on down. And, you know, if I was Donald Trump, I would, you know, and if there's nothing there, I would think, hey, you know, get it over with. Get it done as quickly as possible so that we can move on. But he doesn't seem to be in that mode, which is causing, I think, probably more heartburn over at the White House than, oh, we'll see where it goes. In 2017, yesterday we were 165 days into the year. Today is the 166th day of the year. And yesterday morning, the mass shooting in Arlington, Virginia was the 153rd mass shooting out of the 165 days of this year as of yesterday, followed by the 154th mass shooting in San Francisco. We had so we've got 153 so far, and we're about halfway through the year, a little more than halfway through the year. Last year, 2016, we had 384. We're on our way to a little over 300 right now. That was 2016. 2015, we had 334. And 2014, we had 274. Now, in 2014, there were 100 as of June 14th. Again, we're at 153. In 2015, there were 135 as of June 15th. Last year, there were 142 as of June 15th. This year, there's 153. So it looks like we're on course for the biggest mass shooting year in recent history, anyway. The Gun Violence Archive has verified. There's a great article about this, by the way, over at Huffington Post by Nick Wing. The Gun Violence Archive has verified nearly 7,000 gun deaths so far this year, not including suicides. And by the way, about, as I recall, between a third and a half of gun deaths are suicides. So we've got 7,000 non-suicide deaths so far, 13,000 injuries so far this year. And who are these people who do these mass shootings? You know, I think about a year ago, as I recall. No, this was 2 years ago. In Santa Barbara, Elliot Roger, this lone gunman, killed a bunch of people. He killed seven people. And Karen Tumulty from the Washington Post tweeted out, too many people are seeing the Santa Barbara tragedy as misogyny. It's really about mental illness. What if they're the same thing? What if misogyny is a form of mental illness? Now, follow me on this. This is from a piece in Newsweek by Zachary, and I'm sorry, I can't tell you his last name because Newsweek's print function is screwed up, and the first two pages of every page get chopped off by their header. But in any case, on October 16, 1991, he writes, George Hennard rammed his pickup truck through the front window of a Luby's cafeteria in Killeen, Texas, and opened fire during the lunchtime rush. Wielding two semi-automatic pistols, the unemployed merchant seaman shouted about exacting payback on the people of Bell County. And then his first responders moved in and shot himself in the head. When it was over, 24 people were dead, 20 wounded. The majority were women. That was not an accident. He harbored severe hostility for the women who had, in his warped view, rejected or mistreated him. Survivors of the carnage recall he seemed to pass over male customers at Luby's to shoot women on purpose and point blank. Columbine killer Dylan Klebold wrote extensively about his romantic loneliness and a girl he had a crush on. Adam Lanza, who murdered 20 children and 6 adults at Connecticut's Sandy Hook in 2012, had a Word document on his computer explaining why females are inherently selfish. Even Tim McVeigh, who carried out the Oklahoma City bombing in 1995, complained about his sexual frustrations and women rejecting him. Misogyny. And Casey Quinlan has a great piece over at Think Progress today about this. And she writes about James Hodgkinson, the guy who was the shooter yesterday. He was arrested for assaulting a woman in 2006, according to NBC News, when she tried to get involved in a domestic dispute. Hodgkinson became upset when his daughter refused to leave with him and was also seen throwing his daughter around a bedroom when she refused. He reportedly hit her arms and pulled her hair. Amy Moreland, who was there, told Hodgkinson that she was going to call the police if he kept beating up his daughter. And he punched Amy Moreland in the face. She called the police and filed domestic abuse charges against him, which were later dropped. The guy who shot three people at the Colorado Springs Planned Parenthood Clinic last year, Robert Deere, he had a history of domestic violence. Omar Mateen, the guy who killed 49 people at the Orlando nightclub, perpetrated domestic violence against his ex-wife. In January, Esteban Santiago opened fire in Fort Lauderdale, Hollywood International Airport, killing 5 people. He had allegations of domestic violence on his record and was arrested last year for attacking his girlfriend. In April, Cedric Anderson opened fire in a special ed classroom in an elementary school in San Bernardino, California. Anderson had a history of domestic abuse and went to the school because his wife worked there. He killed her along with one of her 8-year-old students. In fact, and this is where it gets amazing, according to an Every Town for Gun Safety report, during the 2009 to 2016 period, 54% of U.S. mass shootings were related to domestic or family violence. Elliot Roger, who killed 7 people in the shooting rampage in Southern California in 2014 after being romantically rejected by several women, vowed, quote, to slaughter every spoiled, stuck-up blonde slut I see, end quote. So I asked the question, I mean, this is, you know, 54% of mass shootings are committed by people who have a documented history of hating women. To the best of my knowledge, all of these mass shootings are done by men. And if 54% of those men have a documented history of violence against women, and 3/4 of all violence against women in this country is unreported, I think it's probably reasonable to assume that somewhere between 3/4 and 100% of them probably have a history of violence against women. So the question, you know, broadly believed, I think the science is still up in the air about it, but broadly believed that people who molested children were probably going to do it again. We set up this whole system nationwide for people who do child abuse and said, no, you know, if you're convicted of this, you can't live near a school. You have to register as a sex offender or rape. Rape is probably a better example. You know, rapists say, you know, this is a crime that probably somebody who's done it once, they're going to do it again. And so you have to register as a sex offender. And you can't buy a gun. Should we? We've been, you know, I mean, as a culture, as a society, and this is a function of patriarchy. This is a function of male dominance, male supremacy, whatever you want to call it. We have brushed domestic violence under the rug for years. I mean, just in the last century was the first time that issues like rape were really taken seriously. Should we be doing the same with, quote, domestic violence, men who beat their wives or their girlfriends or their kids, their female children? Should we do this? I think so. I think we should be treating domestic violence. If we did, this guy might never have gotten to be this mass shooter. Of course, Virginia doesn't do background checks. So he legally bought that gun and he legally owned that gun and he legally concealed that gun all the way up to the point where he was legal right until he pulled the trigger and shot Steve Scalise. But if Virginia did background checks, and if we treated domestic violence, misogyny, the hatred of women, if we treated domestic violence the same way we treat rape, then James Hodgkinson might not have been able to buy a gun, which means Steve Scalise might have suffered at worst, you know, from having a stone thrown at him.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So anyhow, a lot to talk about. I want to get into that. I want to get into the Fed and the state of the economy. France wants to throw out foreign buyers. Corporate conservative media infiltrating PBS. And welcome back. No free speech TV callers. That's interesting. Call in. I'll put you on the air. This is. Let me get the this article. I just tossed them in my keeper bin here. Keep track of, you know, what I've been doing, but this is. I strongly recommend that you read Casey Quinlan's piece over at Think Progress. But I think that we should go a step beyond this. She said efforts to stop people with histories of domestic abuse from buying or possessing firearms have had mixed results because our laws don't recognize how abuse works, who is targeted, or what behaviors lead up to violence. Excellent point. We've got a caller on Free Speech TV. Joy in Crescent City, California. Hey, Joy, what's up?
Hello, Mr. Hartman. I have been listening to you for years, and I'm quite honored to be on your program this morning.
Thank you. Although, no need. I don't want to seem like Donald Trump in a cabinet meeting, you know?
Believe me, that's not an issue.
Yeah. Okay. So what's up?
Well, I actually made a comment about this topic on my Facebook page. I think that by categorizing domestic violence and labeling it as domestic is diminishing the quality of the violence. It's violence. It doesn't matter that it's domestic. And if I used the example on my Facebook page, if a husband beats up on his wife, he gets counseling. If a man beats up on another man, he ends up in jail.
Right. If he beats up his male neighbor, he goes to jail.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. So I feel that by labeling it domestic violence, it's taking it out, it's removing the fact that this is just violence. And it needs to not be labeled as domestic. They need to treat it in the same way they treat any other physical assault that occurs. And by labeling it as a domestic issue, I think it diminishes the ultimate violence that is happening.
Right. So here, Joy, what you're suggesting is parity, basically, that we treat this like all other violence. I'm suggesting, and right now we're below parity. We're treating it as less than violence. I'm suggesting we treat it as more than violence, like we treat rape as more than violence, because of the probability of recurrence of behaviors, right?
And I think that's legitimate. I think that's a legitimate comment on what domestic violence is.
Yeah, so therefore, either we need to rebrand domestic violence, if that label has been enshrined in laws all over the country. We need to rebrand that essentially as being something in the category of rape rather than in the category of you had an argument, you know, in your family. And you know, seriously go after that, right?
I agree. I think that by like I said, and I don't need to repeat myself, but you know, the violence against women is of epidemic proportions in this country. It's underreported. It is so difficult, and as a victim of rape, I have had to go through the legal system, and this is, it's so prohibitive and so difficult.
Yeah. Wow. I'm sorry to hear that, Joy. Thank you for your call. You really helped clarify it for me. I appreciate it. Thank you very much, Joy. Thank you. And thanks for watching Free Speech TV. We'll be right back. Back, Tom Hartman here with you. So just to clarify this, okay, just to really, you know, now that we know that the 300 or more, close to 400 mass shootings a year that are perpetrated in the United States are almost always perpetrated by men who have beaten up women, who have committed violence against women, which we call domestic violence. You know, as Joy said earlier, if a man beats up his wife, they get counseling. If he beats up his next door neighbor, you know, the man next door, he goes to jail. So if there's like this normal threshold of violence, it's beating up the neighbor next door, right? And going to jail, beating up a guy in traffic or something, you know, road rage, you know, you can go to jail for that. It's called, you know, assault or battery or, you know, aggravated, you know, there's all these different categories, but basically that's assault. So that's sort of the baseline. Now we have, instead of, what we have done is we have diminished domestic violence below that baseline and said, well, domestic violence is not as bad as regular violence. When in fact, there's every indication that domestic violence is an indicator of the potential for something even worse than normal violence, of mass shootings. So if just the simple thing that, you know, if a man, because these are always men who do this, to the best of my knowledge, and if there is a woman out there who is a mass shooter, she is the exception that proves the rule. So if we know that it's men who are engaging in this lower legal category, lower penalty category of behavior called domestic violence, who then go on to become mass shooters. And by the way, there's an element of kind of suicide by cop, go out in a blaze of glory, you know, my girlfriend doesn't love me, so I'm going to shoot up a bunch of people. There's a, you know, I mean, this you can call it mental illness, you can call it whatever you want, but, you know, so if we were to say instead of domestic violence being lower than normal violence in the legal category, we're going to raise it above that, like we did with rape. With rape, we said, okay, rape is not just violence. Rape is something that, you know, rapists tend to be recidivists. They tend to repeat their crime. And so they have to register. They cannot buy weapons. We keep an eye on them. When they move into your neighborhood, you get a notice from LifeLock or whatever it may be. I mean, it's like, you know, this is how it works, right? We should be doing that with domestic violence, in my opinion. And making it much harder for people like that to get guns. You know, all the emphasis on this guy has been on the fact that he had Bernie on his website. And that apparently up until the time that, you know, Bernie dropped out of the primary. I'm not even going to go there. But that focus has completely obscured the fact that this guy has a history of domestic violence. This is the classic profile. I mean, 54% of men who commit mass murders from 2009 to 2016, the last 7 years, 54% of those men who committed those mass murders had documented, in other words, arrests for domestic violence. And, you know, typically you get a lot of violence in before you get arrested. Why don't we elevate this? Along with the National Gun Registry.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-808-9925.
Excuse me, not a National Gun Registry. A national program, you know, where a background check program. National background check. We'll be right back. Welcome to the Tom Hartman University Book Club. Our book today is Walking Your Blues Away, How to Heal the Mind and Create Emotional Well-Being. And we're reading, starting on page 2 in the introduction. The human body is a self-healing organism. When you cut your finger, it heals. If you break your leg, it heals. Even if part of you is cut out in surgery, the surgeon's wound heals. We heal from bacterial and viral invasions, from injuries, from all variety of traumas. The mechanisms of healing are built into us. 5 million years of evolution or the grace of God or both have made our bodies automatic healing machines. So why wouldn't the same be true of our minds and our emotions? All of the traumas that we experience in life leave their wounds. If humankind hadn't had ways of healing from those emotional and psychological blows, over time, society would have become progressively less functional. Instead, history shows us that people usually recover from even the most severe psychological wounds, often learning great lessons or gaining important insights in the recovery process. The famous Kauai, Hawaii longitudinal study of children raised in stressful, disadvantaged conditions, they were migrant farm workers, found that a higher percentage of the children grew up to be highly resilient than did a middle-class control group. The generation that survived the Great Depression and the Nazi Holocaust in Europe went on to create important social institutions, build nations, and offer comfort and hope to humankind. Elie Wiesel's experience specifically comes to mind, although he never would have wished on another, the horrific experience of being in one of Hitler's death camps. Through his writing of that experience, he has given a particularly inspiring model of resilience and healing to the world. The reality is that although adversity breaks some people, it strengthens others. And when people heal from adversity, the old cliche of what doesn't kill you makes you stronger usually rings true. But just as with the production of scar tissue in the healing of a wound to the skin, a process involving millions of cells producing very specific compounds in response to the trauma in the tissue, there must be an inborn mechanism for healing the mind and the emotions. And just as healing from a cut can be speeded up by keeping the wound dry, or can be slowed down by letting the wound get wet and or dirty and irritated, this emotional healing is also a process that can be either stimulated or thwarted by our interventions. In this book, I've identified a specific healing mechanism and process that nature has built into the human mind and body that enables us to process trauma in a way that is quick, functional, and permanent. Just like the skin's mechanism for forming scabs and scars and eventually even making the scars vanish, this mechanism is simple, fundamental, and elegant. In its simplest form, this mechanism involves rhythmic side-to-side stimulation of the body. The side-to-side motion, or bilateral motion, causes nerve impulses to cross the brain from the left hemisphere to the right hemisphere and back at a specific rate or frequency. This cross-patterning produces an organic integration of left hemispheric thinking functions with right hemisphere and brainstem feeling functions. This integration is a necessary precursor to emotional and intellectual healing from trauma. This steady movement of nerve impulses across the hemispheres of the brain is stimulated by the bilateral movement processes of a variety of modern forms of psychotherapy, such as eye movement, desensitization and reprocessing, also known as EMDR, emotional freedom technique, and thought field therapy. In its purest form, however, I've discovered that the natural and rhythmic left-right process of walking while performing a simple mental exercise can also stimulate the same internal integration process. This, I posit, is the way humans have healed themselves for trauma for the hundreds of thousands of years of human history. And it's only because so few of us walk anymore that we have to resort to office-based psychotherapeutic processes to produce a similar result. And that result is impressive. When we stimulate the nervous system in this bilateral manner while calling to mind a persistent emotional distress, the emotional charge associated with that memory quickly and permanently dissipates. This isn't a process of producing amnesia or forgetting. Instead, it's a way of reframing the past, a way of re-understanding or putting into context what has been so unnerving to us. When we perform this bilateral process correctly, the pictures of painful past events in our memory transforms from stark, scary, sound-filled color movies into black and white still pictures that are flattened out and lose their sound. The internal dialogue we have about the events, the tagline that we tell ourselves, and actually hear in our own heads and in our own voices, changes, usually from something like, "That was a painful experience that still scares me," or "I was victimized in that relationship," to a more productive synopsis, such as, "Yes, that happened to me, but it's well in the past now, and I've learned some good lessons from the experience. I can now let go of it." Inciting the movement of nerve impulses across the brain's hemispheres helps people come to terms with their past. They stop being frightened by their imagined futures and feel comfortable and empowered in the present. Walking while holding a traumatic memory in mind in a particular way can produce this result in a very short time. And the book goes on to talk about how exactly to use simple walking, just going out for a 20-minute walk, which is physically good for you. Use that simple walking and combine it with a very specific set of mental exercises that Sigmund Freud and Franz Anton Mesmer and others first discovered years ago. Walking your blues away.
You can support the Tom Hartman Program and see video of our entire three-hour show over at patreon.com/Tom Hartman.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and I'm going to get to your calls on the topics of the day. I just wanted to add one more thing. Mark Sumner just put up a great piece over at dailycos.com, and, quoting the Washington Post and the New York Times. And the headline kind of says it all, but why Trump is really angry: Mueller is following the money. Turns out that, they're not so much looking at Trump
or yeah, I mean, they may be looking at collusion with Russia or whatever. But the main thing that Mueller appears to be looking at is money laundering. This is from the New York Times. A former senior official said Mr. Mueller's investigation was looking at money laundering by Trump associates. The suspicion is that any cooperation with Russian officials most likely have been done in exchange for some kind of financial payoff, and that there would have been an effort to hide the payoffs, most likely by routing them through offshore banking centers. And Mark Sumner, the author of this piece, says looking into money laundering around Trump is like investigating moisture in the middle of the ocean. He says, you want a place to start? Here's an article that from March 6, 2015 in the New York Times, Dateline Washington, D.C. The Financial Crimes Enforcement Network, FinCEN, today imposed a $10 million penalty against Trump Taj Mahal Casino Resort for willful and repeated violations of the Bank Secrecy Act. Terms, you know, and definitions, violating the Bank Secrecy Act is generally called money laundering. Trump Taj Mahal admitted that it failed to implement and maintain an effective anti-money laundering program, failed to report suspicious transactions, failed to properly file required currency transaction reports, and failed to keep appropriate records as required by the BSA. So, you know, hey, you want Trump and money laundering? I mean, it's laying around in the news reports, right? You don't have to do a lot of effort to find that. Anyhow. Back to the other stories of the day. Gail in Tujunga, California. Hey, Gail, thanks for listening on SiriusXM. What's up? Gail, I'm going to have to put you on hold. And Gail's on line 5, Nate, if you want to check out what's going on with her. Sarah in Fort Worth, Texas. Hey, Sarah, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, I'd like to make a comment on, thank you so much for taking my call. Your first caller was, I think, spot on, and we need to stop calling it domestic violence. But I think the other thing that these men suffer from is kind of a self-importance that if you're their girlfriend or if you're their wife, they're property, you know, which is historically kind of been that way, even, you know, in Europe and every place else. You know?
Oh, we've got a 7,000-year history of that in Western civilization.
Absolutely. And there's no... you're basically their slave and therefore, and also their property, and you're allowed to do whatever you want with your property.
Yeah. And that's, I think that kind of thinking, I believe, is the basis of why the so-called domestic violence laws tend to treat domestic violence, which is a euphemism generally for violence against women and children, by men, as a less than assault type of assault.
Yeah.
That's an excellent.
It's not only beating it. I mean, there's a huge problem in this country with verbal abuse. And it, you know,
with what abuse? Verbal abuse. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, which is equally horrific.
Yeah.
And
Its outcome isn't quite as bad, but this is an area where, I mean, this is not unlike, I don't see the there's not an apparent connection between mass shootings and people who are, because virtually all these shootings are done by white men. There's not a clear connection between mass shootings and racism, but it wouldn't surprise me if it was there and just nobody knew it. But there is this clear association between mass shootings and misogyny. But you know, women, people of color, we're looking at male, white male supremacy here on display, in my opinion, sir.
Oh, absolutely, and but I also think it's, well, I guess what you're saying, supremacy, or that they have such a feeling of self-importance, and why aren't you paying attention to me?
Yep.
And I think that resonant in the White House is a perfect example of that.
Yeah, and that's the belief in supremacy, belief in one's own supremacy, for that matter. Excellent points all. Sarah, thank you for the call. Eric in Erie, Pennsylvania. Hey, Eric, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, good afternoon. Listen, this thing you've been riffing on since you started, and by the way, I heard you cry out, hey, where's my free speech people, call in, so I picked up and dialed.
Thank you.
And while I was in the middle of a complicated assembly of a new piece of cat furniture for my three-legged asthmatic kitty who can't go outside.
Oh, wow.
Good
on you, Eric.
He's a good boy. In any event, this thing you've been riffing on about, you know, crime versus crime and relating to recidivism, things like you know, misogynistic and sexual violence. You're absolutely right. It's a pattern I've been discussing with people for years and years, and there's a phrase that I'm sure has been on the tip of your tongue, and now I'll give it to you. There's acts that are crimes under the law, but they're far more a pathology of the human condition. And when you're talking about violence and sexual violence, it's absolutely the sort of thing that has the types of recidivism rates it does because of that.
Yeah.
And to be distinguished from somebody like you or I, if we were in a real tough situation and had to make a conscious choice as reasonable men to steal some food because we were literally suffering from starvation, that's a very different calculation than is a sexual crime.
Right.
And then the other thing is the cycle. You know, you very often, some of the statistics you mentioned, like the domestic violence history for later shooters, that's one that's come up so many times. It's amazing to me how it gets overlooked. But also the fact that many of your adult perpetrators of sexual violence were themselves juvenile victims of sexual violence.
So we have the cycle here. Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, you can almost predict certain probabilities of future behaviors from children who were victimized in certain ways, including domestic violence. You know, if they were beaten or if they observed dad beat mom, this stuff is, it's amazing to me that we as Americans are so anti-science, particularly social science, that when there's an effort, a good thought, an organization, a collection of professionals who want to push policymakers to lean towards early intervention types of programming and training for the kids, that you can look at 8, 10, 12 years old and very accurately predict the kind of criminal and drug and relationship and economic problems.
Oh, I think we need to be teaching, as they do, by the way, in Scandinavia, we need to be teaching about sexual violence and what we're referring to here as domestic violence.
In
preschool and elementary school,
these
behaviors, kids need to be aware of these behaviors when they're 3, 4, 5 years old. And here's why, at least in my theory, Eric, and I'll bounce this off you. You said a minute ago that you felt that this was, you know, part of the human condition was the phrase you used. And we can look at a lot of other species and see what sort of looks like sexual violence or, you know, male dominance, particularly among primates, although it doesn't typically go as pathologically nuts as it does among humans. And you could probably build a case that testosterone is the most dangerous drug in the world. It's responsible for wars. It's responsible for rape. It's responsible for most violence. And so there's an element of nature in here, but there's also a huge element of nurture in here. And that has to do with, as you correctly pointed out, you know, men who are beaten by their fathers tend to go on to beat other people, you know, to be violent themselves when they grow up, you know, not necessarily against their own kids, but, you know, they can, and not all men who have been the victims of physical violence do that. But it is a risk factor. But I would suggest to you that this is in our culture. And just because something is in a, and the fact that it's in our culture is the proof of the fact that it's in our culture is that we treat domestic violence as a lesser crime than regular violence. As Joy said, you know, if you beat up your wife, you get counseling. If you beat up the guy next door, you go to jail. And so just because it's in our culture doesn't mean it's natural, doesn't mean it should be there, doesn't mean it's a good thing. I mean, slavery was once in our culture, right? For example, I mean, lots of horrible things have been in our culture. And for literally for thousands of years, 7,000 years, slavery was part of our culture. And so I think, and that's why I think, you know, what the Swedes, the Danes, the Norwegians, and the Finns have done is so extraordinary in teaching. There was a great piece, I think it was on Huffington Post a couple of days ago. This woman wrote about, you know, feminism and how she grew up in Sweden feeling fully empowered as a woman. And then she came to the United States and it was like, holy cow, I'm a sex object here. And I'm treated completely differently than I was when I was in Sweden. And it's like they have successfully recalibrated their culture away from that. And it starts in preschool and elementary school. And that's what I'm suggesting. Make sense, Eric?
Absolutely, it does. And I actually agree with you completely. I didn't mean to oversimplify. You just always kind of have to have your eye on the clock when you're on the air with you. This is, I would argue, Tom, this is one of the tip of the spear problems in our culture at large.
Yep.
And it's one of those things like, you know, the claims of the gene for alcoholism or something. It's a combination of predisposition plus conditioning.
Yes, absolutely. And the biggest conditioner is culture. And we have some element of control over that. Eric, thank you for the call. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
By the way, Professor Nancy McLean is going to be with us in the third hour of our program today, talking about this extraordinary right-wing conspiracy to take over America. And welcome back. Summer, watching Free Speech TV in Napa, California. Hey, Summer, what's on your mind today?
Oh, hi there. It was your first caller today that just sort of got me to thinking that domestic violence, I would argue, is worse than violence on the street because my home is my sanctuary. This is the one place I should be able to feel safe. It's the last place in the world I should have to be afraid, especially from people who, you know, love me. So, I guess in a way, besides the correlation, you know, between domestic violence and mass shootings, you know, maybe it should be an enhanced crime for sort of violating the sanctity of my home.
That is a great rationale, and I don't mean that to diminish it in any way. That is a great reason for an explicit reason, an understandable reason for amping up those domestic violence laws so that domestic violence is considered a larger crime than beating up your neighbor next door. That is brilliant, Summer. That is brilliant. That's the kind of thing that I think everybody can get. I mean, you know, we all grew up in a household. And most of us, and we all want safety and security. I mean, it's a basic human need, and domestic violence shatters that. And you know, as does rape. By the way, rape is can be more like it didn't happen in your neighborhood or in your backyard or whatever. Trying to draw the analogies between rape and domestic violence are not as strong as between a loss of that sense of safety in domestic violence. That's brilliant. Summer, thank you.
Thank you.
Good talking to you. Jack, watching Free Speech TV in Leander, Texas. Hey, Jack, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I have a little bit of a problem with all the domestic violence talk. And I'll give you a little story here on that. I've been divorced for 20 years, and I don't, you know, have any hostilities against my ex-wife. She ran off with someone else, that's fine. And I just send him a Christmas card every year. The bottom line is, I went in to get a shotgun to go hunting in Louisiana. I live in Texas, went to get a shotgun in Texas at a Target store, I think it was. I don't think I can mention the name of the store, but I did. You can edit that out if you want. And I was told that I couldn't get one because I had a domestic violence charge 20 years ago.
Really?
Yes. And the domestic charge was basically over some bills that my ex-wife was putting underneath a sofa, wouldn't let me go check the mail because I was supporting all five of us in the family, and nobody worked except myself. Which was fine. I didn't care. We didn't have a lot, but we had enough to make it.
We just have a little less than a quarter minute here, Jack. Real quick summary.
Okay. Basically, she decided that we got in a fight over me finding the bills underneath the sofa.
Right.
And, you know, I'll call the cops. 20 years ago, guess who gets arrested?
Yeah. So you feel like you were unfairly arrested.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. So that opens up the other thing is, you know, what happens with somebody who wants to use this as a cudgel, as something to beat somebody with. Thank you, Jack. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you. Jack raises the issue, and I should, let me check into our chat room here and see what people are saying about this, too. Sue Nethercutt notes, and the woman may be dependent upon her husband for money, so it's not just you don't feel safe in your home, but you're also in a position where if the husband is or boyfriend is the breadwinner, as it were, then there's another, you know, inferior, superior, hierarchical relationship there. Excellent point, Sue. Thank you for that. And Jack's, you know, said, well, you know, 20 years ago I was arrested for domestic violence because I got in a fight with my wife and she called the police and accused me of it, but I didn't commit it. I didn't do anything. I just, you know, I was yelling at her. I don't know. I think that it's still, and he said he couldn't buy a gun in Texas for that reason, because it was on his record. I still think that if we're going to, I mean, just like when the crime of rape was elevated, it became a little harder to prosecute rape. But it's also, in this country, we're still not taking rape seriously. I mean, there's hundreds of thousands of rape kits that have not been processed by police departments all over the United States, because we're still not taking this stuff seriously. Anyhow, Patrick in Fort Bragg, California. Hey, Patrick, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Thanks a lot for taking my call. And I'm glad that the guy ahead of me called in and said what he did, because I tend to disagree. I'm a convicted felon. I can never buy a gun or possess a gun or even a knife blade over 6 inches in length. And all of that was for cannabis. So if we really got to compare things, let's say that I think, yeah, you since you are evidently a danger to somebody or were judged that at some time, then, yeah, maybe you shouldn't have a gun. I mean, personally, I don't want a gun. I think that, you know, everybody's touched on a lot of things, you know, social and nurture, but nobody's mentioned religion yet. And the male dominance in religion, including Christianity, I think leads to a lot of the superiority complex that some men feel.
Oh, sure. Look at the Catholic Church. Who can become a priest? Only men.
Right, right. Or several years ago, the Southern Baptist whatever center said that, you know, women are supposed to be obedient, you know, whatever it says.
Well, let's keep in mind, the Southern Baptists split off from the Baptists because they supported slavery back in the day.
Right. But, I mean, I guess what I'm saying is that, you know, I mean, there's so many factors that lead into something like that. You know, I am not proud to say that I've spent 20% of my life between state and federal prisons various times throughout the years, because I believe that cannabis is a medicine, and I'll always fight for that. That's a whole nother conversation.
Wow.
But I've had to live with monsters literally a foot away from me on both sides. Yeah. You know, people that have...
People who really are robbers and rapists and killers.
They've earned the right to be in prison.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that if you take... Forget cannabis, but take nonviolent victimless offenders out of prison, and you put people in prison who hurt other people and violate other people's rights, because that's where they belong.
Yeah. All excellent points. There. Patrick, I need to move along, but thank you for sharing your story with us. And your point is very, very well taken. We need to be looking at these things in a hierarchy, as it were. The cannabis, the drug laws are crazy. I mean, I think there's a broad consensus on that. Patrick, thank you. And I'm sorry to hear that, you know, you went through so much. Renee in Wake Forest, North Carolina. Hey, Renee, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a longtime listener, and this is my first time calling in.
Thank you.
So I may be telling you something that you may be aware of. It's a subculture that I recently learned about called MGTOW, and it may be new to your listeners. It stands for Men Going Their Own Way.
M-G-A-W? Or M-G-O-W, I guess?
T-O-W.
Yeah, okay.
Something like that. So
I have not heard of this.
You can find them mostly on Reddit. That's like one of the forums I like to use.
Right.
And I really don't read it or follow it because some of the comments and the conversations are so vile and violent.
So is this a male supremacy group?
It's a male supremacy group. And the reason why they call it Men Going Their Own Way is because for many, many years, they've been threatening that, hey, women, if you don't treat us right, we're just going to just leave. We're going to leave you behind. Leave, I don't know where they're going, but they're just saying they're just not going to deal with us. And when they see that women are just, we're really going our own way, they can't handle it. And that's where the violence comes from, because I guess they feel from threatening to not deal with women anymore and seeing that some women are okay with it, they just don't know how to handle it. And that's where you see it, like on forums like Reddit, where they're just like, you know, why aren't women, you know, bowing and submitting to us?
Wow.
It's just like that's their expectation. And it's, again, I don't really follow it or read it, but some of the stuff that I read is really disgusting.
Well, and this kind of rhetoric, I mean, when we opened the show, I quoted from a half a dozen mass murderers, mass killers, mass shooters, who were all saying essentially the same thing. You know, it's the guy who said he was going to shoot every woman and using the S word. And now yesterday, James Hodgkinson, you know, this guy, again, it just astonishes me that all of the news coverage that I've seen yesterday and today emphasizes the fact that he had a political bent and doesn't mention the fact that he had a history of domestic violence. When that is the connection to mass shootings, much more than politics. So, yeah, Renee, thank you. Thank you. Excellent points all. I appreciate the call. We'll be back. I want to get into this extraordinary effort to influence the America, in particular the children of America, by the fossil fuel industry. This is going to blow you right after this.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.